Maui or Lahaina, the area, it's been very emotional to see the devastation and destruction that has taken place in that community. And it's hard enough for me to be able to gauge exactly the extent of the damage in that area since, even though we have been there probably 15 times, including personal vacation visits, which has been an incredible blessing, plus going to the feast there a number of times. I just fell in love with the place. I mean, how could you not? We just decided, boy, if we can do it, if we can swing it financially, we're going to try to do that. But as you know, the lives of thousands of people in Maui have just been totally destroyed. It's just been blown up. It's been changed. So let me try to describe this for you, because you've got this mental, you've got this physical image that you've been able to see from the little town, and most of the footage that you've seen on the news has been of just a very, very small area. The downtown area of Lahaina is just, it's destroyed. It's like a nuclear bomb hit that place. It's really been ravaged. The main street of that town, it's called Front Street, and it fronts the ocean. And to show you the scale and how really small it is, from the north end to the south end, you could take a leisurely walk from, you know, basically the downtown area, and there's some homes on the northern side. You could probably take that in a leisurely stroll in, what, even stopping to look at some of the shops and everything, 15, 20 minutes, maybe a half hour. Those of you that have been there, is that about right? It's not miles long. It's just a very, very small, secluded area. And when you get down to the commercial end, or when you got down to the commercial end, it was an area that was just, and it was right near where we had the theater, where we had services. There were just lots of little shops on both sides of the street fronting the ocean, and restaurants, and they're all great. They're all fun to go in and explore. It's not like it's hectic paced. It was just kind of Hawaiian time style, very relaxing. And I guess maybe you could say I'm wearing my Hawaiian shirt in honor of those people today, but even though we wear it all summer long here in the heat. But we're blessed to visit that area for many times, and to see what's happened there is just shocking. It's horrific. It's one of the worst things to view, and obviously for the people there, it's really horrific. Now, the cause is being debated. Obviously, they had high winds, 70, 80 miles an hour from a hurricane. That doesn't seem to be in doubt. Exactly how it started, a lot of debates and a lot of theories and a lot of ideas, and even some sordid, you know, things that people in the past may have called conspiracy theories as to why it's all happened. But certainly in the aftermath, the reaction by public and even federal officials has been horrifying. It's just been amazing. If you've never been there, there's one highway that goes around the west side of the island where Lahaina is, and where, you know, everything that is one of the most visited areas of in the world, everything is happening there. There's some nice resorts, there's a lot of nice condos, there's, you know, some, you know, the things you'd normally expect in Hawaii, like golf and, you know, all sorts of things. But there's only one road, and it's a two-lane road for the most part. And for some reason, I guess maybe to preserve, you know, I mean, while they're searching for bodies and stuff like that, they've really been restrictive in terms of allowing anybody in, which is, I think it's been bad. And then some of the reaction, here people have lost their livelihoods, their homes and everything, and while we're giving away billions and billions and billions of dollars to a foreign country in Ukraine, you know, $700 for each resident that is affected. It's just like, what? Are you kidding me? So it's just, all of that is strange. So I'm not even getting into that. But one thing is for certain, the little town of Lahaina looks like one of the most destroyed, war-scarred cities of all time, which would include Hiroshima And then Dresden, Germany, which was firebombed into non-existence in World War II. You've seen the pictures of that, or Hiroshima, it's basically the same. There's just unbelievable. It looks like war has been waged on this little tiny town of people, but that's the image that I would like you to think about, as bad as it is. That's the image that I'd like you to think about, but instead of applying it from a physical sense, let's transition and now begin to think of it in a spiritual sense and how horrific warfare can be on the spiritual level. My title and my specific purpose today is the same. I don't often do that, but the title and my purpose today, here's the title. This is where we're going. This is the purpose of the message. I really hope that God can help me to fulfill it, because I think it's one of the most important things for all of us as we move forward. The title is Surviving the Wars of the Future. Surviving the Wars of the Future. Now let me begin with this very odd premise. Sometimes you come up with an idea and you really don't have a chance to really check it against yourself. So a lot of times I have a lot, you know, these thoughts roll around in my head and, you know, is that right? Is that good? Is that, and you come back and you cross it out. Well, this is one of those things that didn't get crossed out, so I'm just going to lay it on you. Here's a premise to think about. We are in the future. We are in the future. No, we're not. No, we can't be in the future. We're not in the future because we're in the present. And you, unless some of you or somebody somewhere has learned how to time travel. Now, I personally don't think that is possible, to go into the past or into the future. I don't think that's possible, is it? No, it's not possible, I don't think. But it is possible in your memory to go back in the past, and it is possible to project into the future by what you know. As I've been fond of saying, that the Church of God for, what now, going on 8 decades has been the leader in understanding the future, the leader in understanding Bible prophecy. So obviously, we do live in the present. Okay, we cannot. Can I settle this for once and all? Or will somebody dispute me later? We cannot travel to the future. And we cannot go back to the past. But the events that we have researched for decades seem to be here. Does that make sense? It's like all these things that have been happening in the world are things that, and I just don't want the subtlety of it to deceive us into thinking that we're not there in what we used to call the future. Sometimes I confuse myself, so I hope I'm making some sense. We'll find out later. Mr. Buchanan, what were you talking about today? So, although I tried to come up with a catchy title, The Wars of the Future, Surviving the Wars of the Future, in my view, it's really trying to survive the war of the present day that is important, because we'll always be in the present. So let's think of it in that way. Future, past, present. I know it's kind of, it bends the mind sometimes. But the Bible prophecies and the events of the future that we have taught for many decades, in my opinion, are unfolding. Now, some might disagree, and let's just say that I'm right for the sake of argument, for the sake of just getting something spiritually out of this message today, okay? Let's just assume that Buchanan is right, and if he's not, then it's still good information, because it's not me, it's from the Bible. Now, we know that Bible prophecy teaches us that a main component of the last few years of man's rule is physical war. You know, the Olivet prophecy, wars, rumors of wars. You tracking? Am I right? Am I correct about that? I think I am. But that is not the only one you would like to ultimately survive. That is a physical war. If I can help you survive war, or if I can help myself survive war, I think we'd all want that, right? So, first point, for those of you that take notes, number one, let's get ready for war. Not like the fight announcer, let's get ready to rumble, you've heard that voice. But okay, sounds strange. We should not be for war, and I'm not for war, but since war is in the future, we'll see that it is, and if it's already here and in the present, let's get ready for war, okay? Very simple strategy. Let's turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 10. Because I hope by the time I'm finished, you are convinced that this is really something you need to do. You need to get ready for war. So ponder that. Turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 10. We'll begin right at the beginning of the chapter. Now I, Paul, myself am pleading with you by the meekness and gentleness of Christ, who in presence am lowly among you, but being absent am bold toward you. But I beg you that when I am present, I may not be bold with that confidence by which I intend to be bold against some. I don't really want to be bold, I mean, unless it's necessary, he's saying, who think of us as if we walked according to the flesh, as if this is just some kind of physical thing, in other words. And this is maybe Paul, some postulate, may have been, you know, short side. Maybe he was not a very big man. And so maybe people thought a little less of him because of his physical presence, his physical demeanor or whatever. But he's trying to tell him, look, I've got the authority to be bold. I don't want to be bold. I don't want you to, you know, I don't want to have to use all of this authority that I have that God has given to me. And I want you to demean me because of this. For though we walk in the flesh, we do not, now he's bringing everybody in, we do not war according to the flesh. We don't war according to the flesh. This is part of surviving the wars of the future, is the understanding that we do not war according to the flesh, and we cannot use the physical methods of war, because warring in the flesh is an all-out onslaught to death, you know, to physical death. And the purpose of physical human armies, I love the way Rush Limbaugh put this, the purpose of armies is to kill people and destroy things. That's what their objective is. That's why we have, oh yes, there's a lot of other, you could say, noble reasons for it. Protection, you know, the fact that you have a huge armed forces, you have a huge military budget to dissuade your opponents from attacking you and all of that sort of thing. But basically the reason you maintain an army is that if they have to, they are going to kill the enemy and destroy everything the enemy has. I mean, that's what war is all about. It's distasteful, but I mean, that's the ultimate objective of war. And Paul says that we're in a war, but it's not a physical war like that. But it is a war to achieve victory. And if you are thinking from a physical standpoint, you're just not going to win. You have to have a different strategy. And that leads us to 1 Timothy chapter 1. And verse 18, oh, you know, we're Christians. We don't like to think about battle. We don't like to think about warfare. I know some people don't like the song, Onward Christian Soldiers, because it's almost glorifying war or whatever the reason is, or maybe they don't like the melody. I don't know. But the fact is, just read it here in the Bible. This is, you've been placed in this arena. I've been placed in this arena. It is war. And you have to be able to survive it. And I want to survive it along with you. I want us all together to survive it. And The Bible gives us some answers as to how to survive it. So in 1 Timothy 1 and verse 18, "This charge I commit to you, son Timothy, according to the prophecies previously made concerning you." There was something inspired in maybe his baptism, the fact that Paul could see. There was something inspired about this individual that he was called to a task as a younger man to the ministry. "So according to the prophecies previously made concerning you, that by them you may wage the good warfare." Oh, there's a good warfare. What is it? Let's discover it together. Let's discover what the good warfare for Christians is. Like Timothy, we can explore it. "Having faith and a good conscience." That's great. This shows us, this leads us, that having faith and a good conscience, where does a good conscience come from? A good conscience comes from obedience to God. A good conscience comes from not having regrets. And we all have regrets. We all have things that we need to repent of. We all have things in which we realize, okay, I'm weak there. But the striving to have a good conscience is something that we all, like Timothy was encouraged by Paul, want to have. But the reality is this too, and this is where the warning is. Paul said some reject that. Some reject what causes lack of regret and faith, and they suffered shipwreck, which is as devastating as war. And sometimes shipwreck happens because of war, right? And he specified some individuals, and they were guilty of things, and we've covered those, Philetus, Hymenaeus, Alexander, others that he mentions were victims of a shipwreck because they rejected this information. So it's possible to wage good warfare where victory can be achieved, but not cause death. Not cause death. So Paul wasn't finished with describing warfare to young Timothy, because if you'll turn across to 2 Timothy chapter 2, he brings it up again. The topic of war, spiritual warfare, the idea that a Christian must be ready to go into battle. And I would say not even just be ready to go into battle. The fact is that if you'll accept the premise that the future is here now, okay, kind of a corny way of putting it, right? Me, my corniness. Then, like Timothy, we need to be ready. So 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 3, it says, You therefore must endure hardship as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. No one engaged in warfare entangles himself with the affairs of this life. There needs to be a single-minded focus of a Christian. There's all the other things, Paul said, that you can really put your emphasis on, but if it takes you away from your Christian objective, then not good. So, yes, you have to have a job. You can't just quit your job and be a Christian. But there are things that can tangle you up. Now, what is that? I don't know. It's for everybody to decide for themselves. But it's anything that diverts you away from that main purpose in your life, because you're different. So no one engaged in warfare entangles himself with the affairs of this life, that he may please him who enlisted him as a soldier. So there's going to be priorities, obviously, that are requisite for a Christian soldier. So it may be different for that person and that person over there. It's different things. So whatever takes you away from your main objective as a Christian is what you've got to untangle yourself from. And also, if he competes in athletics, athletics is, you know, the most civil thing that is akin to war, because it involves competition. And so in this sense, Paul is using something competitive, in a sense, It's like war. I mean, you've heard of, if you're a football fan, an American football fan, you've heard football is being described as like war. You know, it's on things that sound like war. It's on a field that sounds like war. It's a gridiron, as George Carlin, the comedian, used to say, that everything about football is resembling war because the contests are in places like War Memorial Stadium, places of remembrance of war. Memorial Stadium was a football and baseball stadium in Baltimore, Maryland, now destroyed and now torn down, but it was Memorial Stadium. It was a memorial of World War II. It was built in the early 50s. So things like that. So football is like a, you know, has been characterized as war, but competition in athletics can almost be warlike, can it not? So this is what Paul is using it. They're not good. War's not good, but athletics can be good. He says, if anyone competes in athletics, he's not crowned unless he competes according to the rules. You've got to stay in bounds. You can't hold as a defender or an offender. You've got to play four downs. You've got to work within the framework of the rules of the contest. So, are you wholly committed in getting ready for war? Are you aware of your surroundings as a soldier must be? Are you taking this seriously? That's the main thing. Let's get ready for war. These are the questions a Christian must ask him or herself. The rules of this warfare are the commandments of God. The whole Bible, obviously. Pretty simple stuff. Point number two. This will either be a really short sermon today or my first couple of points are short. Nobody complains with a short sermon. I found that. Boy, oh boy. Nobody's upset. Point number two. Who are we at war with? Who are we really at war with? Need to make that distinction. Well, we've been covering the book of Revelation in Bible study, and we just recently covered Revelation 12 a few weeks ago. Revelation 12 and verse 7 tells us who we're at war with. So I want to explain to you who we're at war with and who we shouldn't be at war with today too, okay? So keep that in mind as you reflect, and I'm going to ask you to stay while I kind of skip around a bit over something that's pretty familiar, but stay in the book of Revelation for just a second, okay? Revelation 12 and verse 7 says, war broke out in heaven. Michael and his angels fought with the dragon and his angels fought. So keep your place there. This is so well known to you, for most of you, I'm going to refer and I'll read to another passage, which seems to refer to this at least in some ways. Is it something that happened that we're reading about in Revelation 12? Is it something that actually happened in the past? Or is it something that will happen in the future? Is it a combination of both? It's an interesting question, but let's put that one on the shelf for a second. But while you're there in Revelation, you see that there's a war breaking out in heaven and wondering, okay, there's war in heaven. How does that affect us? In Isaiah 14, this is the place, I'll just read this. I've got it right in my notes here. You can just jot it down. You know it. Just stay in Revelation, trust me. But this is mentioned in Isaiah chapter 14, how you are fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning, how you are fallen or cut down to the ground, you who weakened the nations. So in this particular passage, it does seem to be a mixture, an amalgamation of both history and prophecy, possibly. It's darting in and out of what we call the past and the present. It's, for us, along with Ezekiel 28, it's a looking back to what we would call prehistory, before there was even time, before there was the creation of the physical universe, very likely or potentially or at that time. prior to the existence of man as well. And that's where I say, you know, we starting to count time, that's where we begin. Obviously, time existed before then because the universe existed for, as most astronomers, physicists think, maybe 14, 15 billion years. But aside from that, so the description here is about the one who was a created being and was perfect and a light bringer, but he's not that way anymore because he decided to attack. So you're fallen, you're cut down to the ground, you who weakened the nations, which seems to be, from the standpoint of when this originally happened, would be a prophecy, or Isaiah is talking about something that he will do all of his days on this earth. But the main thing, I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will also sit in the mount of the congregation on the farthest sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High, or as some translations put it, I will be the Most High. So obviously an attack against God. Yet you shall be brought down to Sheol, or to hell, the lowest depths of the pit. Now that attack was unsuccessful, and it appears to be something that happened long ago. But in Revelation 12, where you are in verse 17, it shows that the same kind of tactics, that is war, the enraged dragon goes off on a rampage to do what? To make war with the saints, the remnant of saints, as we mentioned. And how is that done? It seems as though the next chapter helps us to understand how this attack is performed, because in Revelation 13 and verse 7, which we've also just recently covered, it shows that the devil will use governments, beasts, to make war with the saints, also repeated, or at least mentioned in Daniel 7 as well, as we covered several Bible studies ago. So the prophecies indicated here suggest that physical engagement of some type will be against the people of God, but we need to be aware of something even more subtle that is happening right now. So what we see is, in these few passages, both Isaiah and Revelation, is that the devil is the guy, or the one, shouldn't call him a guy, devil is the being that started war, originated war. And war has been a part of mankind's history since the beginning, right? Since Cain decided to kill his brother, that's an act of war. Clearly, he's the instigator of war, he's the inventor of war, and he has been determined to make war a part of human life since the time of the Garden of Eden. So, point number three. Since all this war is taking place all through this span of humankind, how do we wage war effectively? Since you've been called to that, let's take a look. And the last point, I think it's the last point. Yeah, the last point is waging war effectively, because that's what we're called to. Now, turn to Galatians chapter 5. And while you're turning to Galatians 5, I'm going to read select portions of Galatians 5, verses 15 through 21. While you're turning there, let me ask you this question, as soon as I can get to it. I remember where Galatians is. Find it. Went past it. Have you heard of the term friendly fire? By a show of hands, how many people have heard the term friendly fire, and do you know what it means? Okay, virtually everybody knows what friendly fire. Would you agree with me that the terminology of friendly fire really means unfriendly fire? Perhaps the most famous recent example of someone being the victim of friendly fire is an ex ASU football player by the name of Pat Tillman, who played at the University to the North, and he was an outstanding defensive back, or maybe he's linebacker. I think he was defensive back. But in the height of his pro career, he decided, because he was very patriotic, to go into the Army. And he became an Army Ranger, one of the higher levels of, you know, their training in the Army. And he was obviously, I mean, he turned down millions and millions of dollars because his career was at its peak. He would have had, you know, more years. Football players don't usually last that long, but he was pretty durable at the time. But he and his brother both went into the military, into the Army. They both became Army Rangers at the same time, which is, it kind of defies what most people would think. Okay, that's really what, but he felt patriotic. He think he was stationed in Afghanistan, and he became the victim of fire, whether it was machine gun fire or artillery fire, I can't remember, but he was killed by friendly fire. Remember that? Does anybody besides me, how about those of you that are not football fans? Have you ever heard of this incident? Okay, so you're not football fans, but you've heard of it. Okay, so Pat Tillman got killed by his own men. Friendly fire, it happens in war. War is, well, look up what Tecumseh Sherman said, Civil War generals. Remember what he said about war. Not good. Well, war is not good. He didn't say it that way. So while you're pondering friendly fire, let's take a look at Galatians chapter 5 and beginning in verse 15. I'm going to skip around here a little bit. It says in verse 15 to the church, if you bite and devour one another, beware lest you be consumed by one another. It's kind of a warning to the church about warfare. You know, it can even happen in the church of God. It can get ugly. I mean, it's just not all peppermint and rainbows and happy times. This is what we want to avoid, this kind of ugliness. I say then, walk in the Spirit, and you shall not fulfill the lust of the flesh. Be motivated by the Spirit of God, and that won't happen to you. And then just the fruit or the works of the flesh are enumerated here, and it's just a measuring stick for all of us. So the flesh lusts against the Spirit against the flesh. They're contrary to one another, so that you do things that so that you do not do the things that you wish. It's a struggle, so folks. Warfare is a struggle. Utilizing the Spirit of God can be a struggle, and I know that probably better than most people. It's hard. It's not easy. We need God's help. So, continuing on in verse 18, in a positive way, if you're led by the Spirit, you're not under the law. In other words, you're not going to reap the penalty of death for breaking the law. If you're led by the Spirit, you're trying to utilize the Spirit of God, you're not under the penalty of law, because Paul said in Romans 3 that the penalty of sin is the breaking of the law, and the penalty in 6:23 is death for breaking that law. So what we find in the remaining parts of this very important portion of the chapter are works of the flesh. So one of the first steps in a Christian's life is to understand that these attitudes, which are mentioned before the fruit of the Spirit, can run amok. They can, even for somebody that has received the Spirit of God, be a continual problem. And I think that we all know that. And those attitudes that are mentioned here, which are contrary to the Spirit of God, are mentioned in verse 19, adultery, fornication, uncleanness, lewdness, idolatry, sorcery, hatred, contentions, jealousies, outbursts of wrath, selfish ambitions, dissensions, heresies, envy, murders, drunkenness. Because to hate somebody is murder, right? All of these things can affect Christians too, if we're not careful. So One of the things that we as Christians who are engaged in warfare need to understand is that we're not immune from any of this. And after 50 years in the church, we haven't, I can tell you personally, we haven't been immune from this. Now, let's turn to the book of James, because James is writing to a group of people who are church members. In James chapter 4, helps us to understand something, that in the first century, the same things were happening. You know, he's writing to people in the church who are among the 12 tribes that are living up way north of where they used to live, where they had been taken, and when they began to migrate, they hadn't migrated yet totally, but they're in this region. And it shows you the region that is mentioned to the 12 tribes which are scattered abroad. So we can isolate, we think, pretty closely as to exactly where it was, but that's not important for this. But just remember that he's speaking to people in a church. He's not just speaking to tribes. He's speaking to people who are actually church members, a very important thing. So he says, where do wars and fights come from among you? Do they not come from your desire for pleasure that war in your members? You know, the same warring effects of the book of Galatians in chapter 5. This is the cause of our problems, these bad attitudes, these wrong things, this disobedience to the law of God. You lust, you do not have. You murder and covet and cannot obtain. And I take it in that sense that the murder that is being spoken of here is hating somebody in your heart, and having hatred toward another individual, even unbelievable as it may seem, towards somebody within the church of God. You fight in war, yet you do not have because you don't ask. You're not close to God. You're not doing the things that would put you in close proximity, and you are members that you're doing things that just are separating you from God. You ask and you do not receive. And this seems to be a mirror of what was happening in the society of that day and age. Because there were wars taking place around the time of this writing. And those wars did seem to be taking place in the areas to where these tribes were migrating. And how often do we find that in the church of God throughout the time that we have been, we can mirror some of the problems in the world, because that's the world we came out of, but that's the same influence that is influencing the world, is broadcasting attitudes, as we read in Ephesians 2, and just broadcasting these attitudes of hatred and envy and lust that James is speaking about here. Middle of verse 3, verse 4, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Whoever therefore wants to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. We've got to pull away from the world without withdrawing. Verse 5, do you think that the scripture says in vain, the spirit which dwells in us yearns jealously? It's talking about the same competitive aspect of that is in the mind that Paul speaks about in Galatians 4. You know, the war against the flesh and the spirit together. Paul mentions it in the book of Romans. The things that I want to do, I find that I can't sometimes. And the things that I don't want to do, I end up doing. And it's just a war, right? It's kind of an internal struggle. Verse 6, but he gives grace. Therefore, he says, God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble. So this is one of the cures, humility. And how do we get that? In verse 7, it says, therefore, submit to God. And here's the kicker. When we understand and are able to analyze fully what is happening, it's the devil. So we resist the devil, and he will flee from you. That's a guaranteed. So the closer you are to God, the more you resist all of these impulses that are wrong of the flesh, the hatred and the anger and all the works of the flesh, the less impact the devil has with you. And that's why my kind of theory, and I don't necessarily think it's just a theory, I think it's fact, is that, I'm not going to turn there, but when you analyze Ephesians 2 and verse 2, and Mr. Armstrong used to describe that as the influence of the devil broadcasting in attitudes to this world, and then when you recognize also that Paul told Timothy that evil men would become worse and worse as time goes on. If we get to that point to where, okay, if I as a minister of God, if I identify somebody as having an evil motive, isn't that exactly what Paul told Timothy would happen? I mean, I've talked about the individuals that are leaders of this world, and we kind of inject some of our own morality to virtually everybody. Unconsciously, we do that. But if I say that the leaders of this world, without naming names, are evil, and they have brought us to this particular point, or potentially, let's just, you know, go outrageous here for a second, go conspiracy idea. If I say that maybe some of the problems that have occurred and are occurring in the little town of Lahaina might be the result of people that have evil motives, isn't that exactly, or any other situation, right? Isn't that exactly what the Bible has told us is going to happen? If I say, for instance, as I have done, that the leaders of this world are leading us in a direction that we don't want to go and that we shouldn't listen to them and that we don't have to listen to them, we do not have to obey them in certain things. Now, we have to pay our taxes. We have to do that. We have to do all the things that Christ said that we render unto Caesar what is Caesar's. But if I say that this person has evil motivation, and they do, isn't that exactly what the Bible has warned us of? And so why would we be resistant to the idea then that we're at the doorstep if we haven't crossed the threshold already? And so I think that what you need to be prepared about is that, because from a spiritual perspective and from a physical perspective, the things that work in the past are likely to be replicated in the future. And if the object of the devil is to take over mankind and make him subservient and actually get rid of him, then we will see that reflected within the people who have a reception. Like, okay, this doesn't have an antenna that you can see, but it does have an antenna. So my point is this: the people who are more resistant to God in this age are the ones that are going to be more receptive to the devil. And those are the people you really have to be careful for. I mean, I've said for years that many in leadership positions do not have your best interests at heart. And that has seemingly gone to a scale that is huge now. So when they come out and they tell you, you've got to do this, it's not really because they love you or care for you. And if what they did to us a few years ago is virtually proven at this time now. I mean, there's absolutely no doubt about it. I mean, if you really pay attention, that the problems were created by the individuals that have evil motives. And then they come along with their little solutions to try to solve all those problems they created to begin with. Why would we doubt that? Why would we think, oh, they couldn't do that? Why would anybody do that? Don't do that again, if you did. Don't do that in the future. Because if they tell you, okay, this, we're going to have, like, it's almost being projected now. There are going to be all these horrible things that are going to happen. They're going to happen to you, so you must do this. Well, as much as possible, don't do that. Don't do what they tell you to do to avoid all the problems that they created in the first place, because you should know that they have evil intent on their minds for you. Here's an example. I can cite this because this is something you can easily look up. I was a pharma guy, right? Love me, hate me. Okay, so one of the CEOs of one of the largest companies that was heavily engaged in all this mess of the last few years, you can look it up. His name is Albert Bourla. He's a Greek. He is a veterinarian by trade. He is the CEO of Pfizer. I'm not gossiping about him. It's in the public record. But he said in the World Economic Forum of, I think it was 2019, that our goal is to reduce the world's population by 50% by 2023. Look it up. Now, that's a drastic reduction. You can see him. He's being interviewed by Klaus Schwab, and they're talking like it's a normal thing. I mean, it's shockingly crazy to watch it. So this is why I say, I mean, these people don't have your best interests in mind. So if they want to lock you down again, believe me, it's not because they have great love for humankind. And it's almost, you know, it would sound crazy or conspiratorial or paranoia, but I know they're after me. Just kidding. So they might be. But the point is, the armament of a Christian is different than the armaments of modern warfare in the physical way. But you resist the devil, he'll flee from you. Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners. Purify your hearts, you double-minded. This is the antidote towards the attacks of the devil. Lament and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned to mourning and your joy to gloom. Humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord, and he will lift you up. This is a matter of a personal responsibility in your daily devotion with God. So the lesson really for us as Christians is, let's not inflict casualties among ourselves. Let's not cause friendly fire. Let's not be that one that accidentally, or certainly not purposely, has unfriendly fire towards one another. Does that make sense? And the way to do it is to follow these instructions that James gave to people who were, you know, having problems with one another. Now, what can we do to immediately stop the war by the devil against us? Well, let's turn to Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 11. Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 11. It's pretty well known. It's pretty straightforward. We're talking here about the armament of God. This is how we resist the devil. We take up the whole armor of God. And while I'm just blathering on, just read through that passage from Ephesians 6, 11 through 14. Because all of these things were well known in the day, the audience that Paul was speaking to. And in verse 14, he says, "Stand therefore, having girded your waist with truth, having put on the breastplate of righteousness." So the word "stand" here, Paul is using a military term of the day. It means to stand your ground in battle. So we're not in a physical battle, but now we have to stand ground, stand still, as Moses said, you know, stand still and watch God deliver you at the parting of the Red Sea. But the word here is stand, and Paul's using this as a military term, and it means just, okay, you're going to stand your ground in battle. You're not going to retreat. Okay? Don't retreat. Stand your ground. So we're being admonished to stand our ground against the wiles, the strategies, and the tactics of the master of war. Daunting, right? Yeah. Spiritually daunting. Now, the word wiles from West's Word Studies of the Greek New Testament says the word wiles is methodia in Greek. It means cunning arts, deceit, craft, trickery. The word comes from the verbal form of method, which is to follow up or investigate by method and settled plan, to follow craftily, frame devices and deceive. So there's been a lot of thought put into how we can be deceived by the devil. And he rarely changes these tactics. And that's why through the years in the Church of God, whether it's doctrine or whether it's the problems among members, the same things are used over and over and over and over again. Just like what we're seeing now is that we may see the same things that were used upon us in 2020 and on, we may see them being brought back to be used against us. Why? Because they work. Just like the strategies, the wiles, the methodology of the devil It's the same. It keeps coming up time and time and time and time again. Because it works. There's a certain number of casualties that occur because of it. I'm pleading with you to understand this. I really am. Because I've seen it over and over and over again. And yes, we all fall victim to these strategies from time to time if we're not close to God. So the wiles of the devil are invented by the master of war. And, you know, his aim, his strategy is against us right now. I can guarantee you that. It is against us, and we're all individuals, members of the body, so that means he's after you. Okay, like I told the kids, Friday night dinner, you know, when I knew at one time when they'd be kind of breaking loose on their own and be going out, look, nothing good happens after 12 midnight on Saturday, which is basically true. Nothing good happens when you're out in the night after 12. You've got a bullseye as a Church of God kid painted on your back, and all of us do. We all have the bullseye. So what is he going to use, and what has he used in the past? Division is the main tactic that the devil has, because he wants to split the church. He doesn't want us to cooperate. He doesn't want us to use our gifts together. He doesn't want us to have fun together. He wants us at odds with one another. Satan knows that we're going to be a lot less effective if there's division within the body. Tries to get people to distrust one another. Tries to get people to whisper against each other. It just has this ability and tactic to be able to divide people. And because we're human, sometimes we fall prey to it. Look, I have too. Very heart to heart here. He'll do anything to separate us. So one of the things that we can do to stand our ground against this onslaught, this very wicked and evil onslaught, is found in 2 Corinthians chapter 2 and verse 10. Here is one of the main antidotes that can be used to stand your ground. One of the main things, probably the most important thing I'll say today, 2 Corinthians chapter 2, verses 10. Now whom you forgive anything, I also forgive. Forgiveness is the antidote and one of the main attributes of a Christian in standing your ground. Now this had to do with a serious situation that took place in the congregation, one that required discipline, and one that required the awareness of the people to exercise discipline among themselves. We also find, hey, this is great news. This is great news that whatever the problem was resolved. There was repentance, and the congregation accepted it. Amazing. Forgiveness is the antidote to the wiles of the devil. So let me ask this question. Have any of you ever had hurt feelings? Nobody here? No, not one person. No hurt feelings, right? Has anybody? Okay, so we got no takers on that one. I jest. How about, has anybody here ever been offended? Again, I've got the perfect congregation. It's because I've been here so long that I've helped you so great that you've never been offended. I'm jesting. You know, nobody. Okay, so haven't we all been offended? Haven't we all had our feelings hurt? One time, I mean, sometimes you do things, you didn't mean to hurt anybody's feelings, but you do. And then that person gets a really hurt feeling, and they don't tell you, they're angry at you. Somebody was angry at me for not shaking their hand when I'd shaken, I guess, everybody else's hand around them. And I didn't think about it. You know, I was rushed. I was, you know, doing my minister thing, coming in and whatever. And, you know, I didn't mean to offend. I just did. I apologized. There's a lot of times you have to apologize for things you never knew you did. Just do it. But on the other end, forgiveness. It's great. I was recently asked this question, well, how many times should we tolerate that? What about 70 times 7? It's funny. All right, so I think you know that. Satan is the cause of hurt feelings, by the way. He's the one that causes offenses to split us apart because that's what he wants. He wants us at odds with one another and getting angry and suspecting one another. I mean, in the church, wow. So if you've ever been offended, you know, I guess my parents would just tell me, just get over it. You know, it's like if you fall down in the street and you come wailing in, you know, it finally gets to the point where, you know, yeah, there's blood, there's stones still in your arm and whatever, but at some point you got to shut up. Get over it. Really being blunt here. But isn't that true of virtually all these things we're talking about when people get offended? Look, at some point when there's repentance, there should be forgiveness. Just get over it. Get over yourself. I mean, my parents told us that too. So all of this takes cooperation. Now look, we're going to have to be working with one another for eternity. It's going to take some cooperation. We're going to love doing it. It's not going to be hard. We're going to move to this point of getting over, you know, we're going to be using the spiritual implements at our disposal. The weapons of our warfare are spiritual, as Paul says. So one of the things in standing your ground is, you know, Ephesians 6 talks about the shield, you know, the shield of faith. It was called a testudo. The Romans called that. And one of the things that they did, you know, when they were advancing forward or standing their ground is they'd close ranks, right? They close ranks together and they'd put their shields up and they would overlap one another. And they did that to deflect the arrows that might come their way. And of course, we know that there are the fiery darts, the arrows of the wicked. And so the imagery is for all of us to close ranks, put up our testudos, and flank this off. That means working together, right? There's so many great examples of that have happened through history of God's people. The church of God and the body of Christ is going to be a lot more effective when we're unified then and coordinating and working together. And I'm just saying that because the future is here and it's now and it's coming upon us, and we've got to recognize that any divisions in the body are probably the result of the adversary's efforts against us. So let's continue to, I mean, I really feel like I've got one of the easiest jobs in the church of God, because you all are great. And I mean that very sincerely. I mean, it's a good place to be for a minister. It's low maintenance. It's, except for a couple of you, but no, I'm just kidding. It's fun. But I know what the future holds. And it's the present, actually, that is there. So what can we do? What can we all do? Let's go back to the beginning of chapter 4 for the final passage here. What can we all do? Let's close on something really positive here, okay? In verse 1, it says, I therefore, the prisoner of the Lord, beseech you that you walk worthy in the vocation wherewith you are called, with all lowliness and meekness, with longsuffering, forbearing one another in love, endeavoring to keep the unity of the Spirit and the bond of peace. Pretty long sentence, but endeavoring means that we've got to be energetic about it and zealous and diligent. We've got to do something with effort and motivation. It's got to be something that comes from within. It's got to be something that God has placed in us. We've got to strive to build and maintain unity in the body of Christ. So you can do that. You can do it. So we have spiritual weapons at our disposal. So let's make ourselves available of those, or make those available to ourselves. They're right there, the law of God. The physical and a spiritual warfare is going to increase. I mean, we might see more physical warfare. We may see more physical problems imposed upon society in the near future. You know, things have settled down in the world. Mr. Shaby talked about it a couple weeks ago in the sermon, right? Things have kind of returned to normal. And then we've got this Maui fire. And it's, you know, this is horrific. You've got some sense of normalcy, but you know it's not. You know the world is forever changed. Will there be something dramatic that happens? Will they try to reinstitute a lot of these mandates and these lockdowns and do this stuff in the very near future now that, okay, our guard is down? I don't know. They could. They meaning the powers that be. But we're heading right into this, folks. Revelation 12, Revelation 13, and we have got to be prepared. If I've missed anything, or if I've been ineffective in my presentation telling you what you need to do, as Christians, you need to go into the Bible and find out what the things you need to do for yourself are. Let me just say that. So let's engage in the spiritual warfare, always training to win.